Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Now, as a practice owner, you've probably wondered, how do I become a better leader? Perhaps you've questioned your own type of leadership or your style of leadership at various times in your practicing life. And if you've ever had those thoughts, then you're going to really resonate with this particular episode. My guest today is Professor Barry Posner, and Barry has studied leadership and entrepreneurship for over 30 years. He's authored over 12 books on the topic. One of those books, which is called The Leadership Challenge, has sold over 3 million copies. It's up to its 7th edition. It's been published in umpteen different languages. Barry has consulted to companies like Apple and Amazon and WD-40, to name just a few. He's incredibly well respected in the field of leadership. And in our conversation today, we talk about 5 key practices really that are useful and helpful for every leader, irrespective of the circumstances. We know that leadership is something that can be learned. It's a skill like any other that can be learned. We know that there are basic principles that govern leadership, and whether the context shifts and changes from one day to the next or into the future, we know that these principles will serve you very well. So in this episode, we're going to unpack those 5 principles. And as always, do have a pen and paper handy, because what Barry shares is some really thought-provoking strategies there for you. What I enjoyed about this conversation is it's not a didactic, do this, do that kind of thing. It's 5 key principles for you to think about, to make your own, and to apply in the circumstances as they see fit. And I think this is going to be a really useful episode that you'll want to come back and really reflect on and think about as you move forward. Now, if you happen to be a motivated, driven practice owner, please come and join us in the Savvy Dentist Facebook group, because in that group, we're going to give you some training tools and tips to help you take your practice to the next level. Whatever that means for you, we want to see you either increase your income, have more free time, or just enjoy that journey a bit more, then there's going to be things in that group right there for you. So please head across to Savvy Dentist in Facebook, find us there, answer a few questions upon entry, and we'd love to welcome you to the group. But for now, let's get on to our conversation with Professor Barry Posner. Barry, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the Savvy Dentist Podcast. You're coming to us all the way from the San Francisco Bay Area. How's things over in your neck of the woods?
Well, things are great. You know, we're in a different season. We're, finishing up spring, coming into summer. And you're doing just the opposite.
We are, and I live in Canberra, which I know you know where Canberra is because you've been, and it gets cold here. So we are definitely going into winter, looking forward to spring on the other side, shall we say.
Right.
Barry, you're incredibly well known in the leadership space. Your book, The Leadership Challenge, had 7 editions. I read somewhere it's had over 3 million copies sold. It's one of over a dozen books that you've written on the topic of leadership. What caused you to become so fascinated about the topic of leadership? Where did that fascination begin, and what is it that captures your attention after all these years?
Well, good question. I think originally my colleague Jim Kouzis and I got interested in leadership back in the early 1980s as we were a part of a group taking a look at what makes for excellent companies and how you go about setting a corporate culture that works for people. And a lot of that had to do with leadership and tone at the top. But the more we began to do some research, we riffed off this question in the 1980s, and we continue to do this today. We asked people to tell us about a time they'd been at their personal best as a leader. All your listeners now can be thinking about, maybe starting the business that they're now involved in. Maybe that was their personal best. But think about a time you were at your personal best as a leader, and think about the key behaviors and actions that you took then that made a difference. And from that question, now thousands of case studies and hundreds of interviews and millions of survey respondents, we discovered 2 really important big issues that I think are interesting. One is that everybody had a story to tell. Mm. And I'm just teasing your listeners to say, even in Australia, everybody had a story to tell. And everybody had a story to tell in England. Everybody had a story to tell in New Zealand. Everybody had a story to tell in California. And everybody had a story to tell, whether they were teenagers or senior citizens, whether they were just starting out their careers or had been working for many years. discipline didn't make a difference. Gender didn't make a difference. Everybody had a story. Now, just think about the implication of that. Everybody's got a story to tell. And when we listened to people talk about their stories, what we found was that while the context was always different, the key actions and behaviors were more similar than they were different. And so just right there, we began to realize that leadership is within the capability of everyone and that we actually know what leadership looks like. It's not so mysterious or esoteric that people can't grasp it. They know what leadership looks like. It's hard. It's not necessarily easy to do. But if we know what it looks like, then we can learn it and we can develop it and people can get better at it. And in that sense, you know, we take the view that leadership's a skill. Any skill, you know, everybody listening in today can sing. Some people can sing better than others, but everybody could sing better if they wanted to, big if they wanted to. And then if they were willing to get some good coaching, like listening to your podcast, and if they were willing to practice, because you can't get better without doing something different than you're now doing.
It's really interesting. You said that, tell us about a time when you were at your best as a leader. And you mentioned that everyone had a story and the context was different, but the behaviors, the actions and the thought processes in that were very similar.
Right.
But the fact that everyone had a story also tells me that every single one of us has at some point been in a position of leadership. Maybe it's been self-leadership. Maybe it's been leading others. And so I wondered what your thoughts were about the fact that everyone has that story. Is it the fact that everyone has a role of leadership at some point in their life? Is it because everyone has obviously accessed those skills at some point in their life? The fact that it's a skill, obviously you've highlighted, but what else comes out of that part of the research?
What you're maybe struggling with is the difference between leadership and being called a leader.
Yes.
Leadership doesn't require any particular position or place in an organization. An example, I'm teaching an undergraduate class on leadership and one young man misses the first two classes and I'm not very happy with that. And he comes into class on the third class and I kind of give him a hard time and he's done the assignment, which was to describe his personal best leadership experience. And it just happened that week. It just happened that week that he was the youngest of five kids, 19 years old, youngest of five kids. His mother unexpectedly dies. He's the one that discovers his mom in the house. His father is just distraught, can't somehow seem to get it together. His older brothers and sisters are no longer at home. And so at 19 years of age, he's responsible for kind of holding the family together, figuring out what to do with his mom, organizing the funeral. And so this becomes, at that particular point in time, that becomes his personal best leadership experience. Now, Ignacio's gone on, you know, to do many other things. But that's what I mean. It doesn't have to be, you know, you become the CEO of Westpac and that's your personal best leadership experience. It could be, Jess, it could be you start a podcast. You had to create it. You had to come up with the idea. You know, you had to get other people excited about this idea. We're going to talk about how you had to model the way. You had to inspire a shared vision. You had to challenge the process. You had to do something maybe you had never done before. You needed to enable others to act. You needed to build a team of people. And along the way, you needed to encourage the heart to make sure that, you know, you didn't burn yourself out. I'm just guessing one of your personal bests.
You've guessed well. I am very, very proud of the podcast. It's the thing that gets me out of bed every single day. I enjoy talking to people, having interesting conversations such as this with interesting people. So you've just listed out the practices that you talk about in your book, The Leadership Challenge. So I guess this is a really, obviously timely point to jump into those commonalities that you saw when you interviewed those people about their personal best. Were these the practices that came out of those interviews, these five practices you've just listed out there?
Well, Jess, yes. I mean, these are the names that we gave to the five, to what people were telling us. But no one necessarily said, hey, when I was at my personal best, I modeled the way.
No.
I inspired a shared vision.
No.
But what they said to us, for example, they said to us was, you know, I was driven. I was highly committed. I didn't ask anybody to do something I wasn't willing to do myself. I could see where this thing that I wanted to do resonated with my values and who I was. And I had to lead by example. I had to set an example for others. I had to, you know, those kinds of comments people told us about. And when we put all those comments into a bucket, and so that we can talk about this in a general way, we called that model the way. Getting clear about who you are, what's important to you, and then making sure that you, I think this is a Australian word, dwizzywit, do what you say you will do.
Actually, I haven't heard that. So you've just educated me on an Australianism. So thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, it's making its way down under, I
guess.
There
we go. You better patent that.
That's what people told us they were doing. And for the sake of educating and developing in an organization, for example, a common language so that we can go around and say, hey, are we modeling the way? Are we setting the example for others? When people were at their personal best, again, they didn't say I inspired a shared vision, but there were three important ideas. They had, and they didn't even always use the word vision. They had a mission. They had a purpose. They had a burning agenda. They had something in the future that captivated them and compelled them to go forward. They had to get others to buy into. I mean, you know, that's a word that they used a lot. If in real estate it's location, location, location. For leaders, it's communicate, communicate, communicate. So I had to keep telling people over and over again why safety is so important in our organization, or why customer service is so important in our organization. I had to get everybody on the same page. And I had to do that. Again, no one really said I inspired anybody, but they said I was enthusiastic. I was energetic. One nursing supervisor put it this way: I infected others with my enthusiasm, contagiously enthusiastic. So that's what we mean by kind of inspiring a shared vision. You know, when you ask me or you ask others to come on to talk with your audience, you do that in a way that says, "Hey, listen, this would be really important. Here's my vision." And if you say to me, you say, Barry, if you think this is important and this would be an important group to talk with, I'd love for you to do that. That's how you inspire a shared vision, and people want to volunteer and say, sure, I'll go there. When people were at their personal best, they weren't doing something that had already been done. They might be doing something that was already done, but they were going to do it better than it had ever been done before. So maybe a church, it was a big fundraising event, and you have that every year. But this year, you set an audacious goal. This year, you were going to do something to surprise people that hadn't ever been done before. And so when people were at their personal best, they moved outside of their comfort zone. Particularly from a leadership perspective, they experimented.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to do something that you've never done before, you got to try. You got to try, fail, learn. And the best leaders are the best learners, are the people who are constantly trying to learn. And the only way we learn is by trying to do things we haven't done before. In that sense, leaders are like scientists. They have a hypothesis. I think that if I do this, it might have this effect. And then they try it, and then they see what happens, and they adjust accordingly. They search for opportunities. That's really important. I think in some ways, again, your listeners are challenging the process when they listen to your podcast, because they're hoping that, you know, maybe this guy that's, you know, across the ocean might have an idea that they could take back into their organization. I don't know anybody that's on the podcast, but maybe there's an idea that I might share that they can figure out how to use in their business. The fourth practice, we call it enabling others to act, and it reflects the paradox of how leaders turn their followers into leaders. Mm. So a high performing team, everybody feels like they're making a difference, and fundamentally, Jess, that's what leaders want to do. They want to make a difference. I think everyone wants to make a difference.
I think so too.
They just need the opportunity to do that. And leaders work to build people's competence and their self-confidence that they can do things. And they connect people. They build relationships. And the essence of any relationship is built on trust. if you don't trust somebody, you're not going to work very hard with them or for them. And then finally, our fifth practice we call encourage the heart. Once again, not a phrase that anybody necessarily used, except lots of people talked about, think about the word encourage. The root of that is courage. If we're going to ask somebody to do something they've never done before, well, there's a reason they're not doing it. They don't feel safe. They don't feel competent. They feel like they might be hurt or punished. So we need to give people the courage to do things they've never done before. And part of the ways that we do that is to let people know that we have their backs, that we celebrate kind of individual accomplishments and recognize that, you know, it takes a village. You can't do it all by yourself. So we build a sense of, again, a wonderful word, community, common unity. So it's the three musketeers, all for one and one for all. And in that sense, if there's not a sense of playfulness and fun in the work that we do, people can work hard, but they're going to eventually burn out and they're not going to stick around for the next possible personal best. So these five practices, again, they're not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 as if I might have talked about them in that way. There's a gestalt. When people tell me their stories, they don't, you know, they jump around more than I have in trying to organize this for you and your audience.
Yeah, I think what you've provided, though, is a really nice framework and a way of thinking about some of those common attributes of, you know, leaders at their personal best. You mentioned a word that I'd just like to come back and focus on for a moment, and that was connection.
Right.
And it's interesting, I was having a conversation with someone today about the difference between communication and connection. And I wondered, in the leadership context, whether you had any thoughts about whether that difference is significant or not, or whether you see, you know, communicate, you know, and our shared vision or what we're passionate about versus connecting at that really human level. I'm just wondering what thoughts you might have around that particular topic.
Well, it's hard to connect without communicating. It's hard for anybody to follow you if they don't know who you are and what you're about and what you're thinking. Part of that is the willingness to talk about how you're doing and what you think needs to happen and what your standards, what your values are. Because fundamentally, leadership is a relationship. Mm. We sometimes, you know, might tease an audience and sort of say, well, how would you know if somebody was a leader? And, you know, people will come up with all kinds of things. But in the end, the real kicker is anybody following them? Nobody's following them. It doesn't make a difference how tall they are, how loud they are, how smart they are. None of those things matter. So why would anybody want to follow you? And kind of the relationships are sustained because we believe that being with this other person, we're better off than we would be if we weren't.
Yeah.
If any of your audience is still married, they understand that. You know, I want to be with this person, and whether that person, you know, is a partner or is a direct report or is a colleague, I want to be with this person because they make me feel good about myself, because they think I'm smart. They think I'm talented. They listen to me. They ask for my advice. They take my input. They know my name. Gosh, somebody asked me recently, Jess asked me, so in this distributed world that we live in, and as organizations are getting flatter, you know, and for some of your small business owners, you might ask, well, when does my company get too big? And I'd say it gets too big when you can't remember the names of all the people who work in your company. Nobody wants to be in a relationship with the boss who doesn't even know who you are.
It's a really interesting thought to understand the commonalities of those personal bests. I wanted just to change tack for a second, Barry, and I'd like to just ask about the challenges that come up with leadership, because a lot of dental practice owners, who our audience are, struggle with leadership. They do feel that, many people feel like it's a skill that they have to invest inordinate amount of time in. In other words, is the trade-off worth it? I think most of us would appreciate that it is worth it if you get it right. What are the challenges that you see business owners coming up against day in, day out? What are the things where you, if you could just tap them on the shoulder quietly and say, hey, maybe here's a better way. What are the mistakes or challenges that you see happening routinely Because if we can identify those challenges, we can then identify what to do about them.
I think, you know, we mentioned this before. I think trust is really an important concept, and it goes two ways. One is you got to trust yourself, and then you got to trust others. One of the problems that happens, I think, particularly for small business owners, is their feeling that nobody cares about the business as much as they do. And therefore, they have to be on top of everything. They have to be smarter than everybody. They have to know 100% of what's going on. They find it difficult to delegate, or they're micromanaging people to the extent to which those folks, and you know, begin to doubt their own competency. You know, I had a leader recently who had a different kind of epiphany and realized that all the questions and checking in that she was doing with her direct reports was making them feel like she didn't think they were capable, which was exactly the opposite. But the way that she was treating them made them feel that they weren't very capable, and then they started doubting themselves. Gosh, one of the best things that's happened came out of the pandemic was that lots of organizations moved decisions further down the chain, you know, right down to the front line, because that's where the action was and people needed to step up. And for the most part, they did. And just as we've said, after the world wars, after they've seen Paris, you know, it's hard to come home. So after you've had an opportunity to make some decisions and to take responsibility, it's hard then to go back and sort of, you know, be treated again like a child.
Just in your experience, have people kind of divested themselves of that responsibility, given it, you know, pushed that responsibility and decision-making to the front line, which probably is where the knowledge lies as well, because they're the people dealing with that on a day-to-day basis. Are you aware of any instances now that the pandemic is kind of, I don't want to say over, because here in Australia we're going through a bit of a COVID surge at the moment, but have you noticed that as companies have moved back into the offices or gone back to pre-pandemic settings, is that responsibility being taken back off those people now, and is that causing issues? Or are you saying that actually we've discovered a better way of working and we're going to stick with what we learned in the pandemic?
I think it's a muddy kind of terrain.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Surveys show that employees feel like they've been more productive being able to work on their own from home, from anywhere, while their managers have sensed that they're not, you know, they're goofing off, that they're not doing as much.
Yeah.
And for my money, I trust the people.
Yeah.
And part of that means then that as a manager, I need to figure out what are the other things that I should be doing, like removing obstacles that my people might face so that they can do their work, like making sure that I recognize them for who they are and for what they do, and so that they feel appreciated. Good times or bad times, we're always still dealing with retention and make sure that the best people stay in our organizations, or that they don't kind of quit on the job. You know, there's, you know, people here in the States and people in Australia, you know, who continue to schedule their sick days. They're not sick, they're just not attached to their jobs. And, you know, I bet you all of the listeners here can't even think about the last time they took a sick day, because they're so committed to the organization.
And that's the thing, is this goes back to what you said a moment ago. I think one of the common fallacies is the fact that, you know, the small business owner feels like no one cares as much as they do, so they don't take the sick day and all those things. And the truth is maybe a lot of the people on their team do care greatly, and I think, you know, recognizing that. I want to just talk about trust. You've made trust a bit of a central theme of the conversation thus far. How do you know when there is an absence of trust? I mean, I've got my own thoughts and feelings about that, but you've researched this, you've looked at the data, you've spoken to, you know, countless people about, you know, these sorts of issues. What does the absence of trust look like in a workplace? What sort of things might you observe in a workplace that doesn't have trust? And then I guess the follow-up question will be, how do you engender trust?
Well, it's really a binomial, because you can sort of say, well, here's why you don't have trust, and here's what you need to do to have trust. So, for example, when you find that people don't share ideas, it probably means that they don't feel safe. Mm-hmm. They don't feel that they can trust that people will pay attention to them or might laugh at them or might hurt them in one way or the other. When people feel like like the people around them can be trusted. Trusted to listen to your ideas, even if they're not, you know, fully developed. Trusted to that when you ask a question, you're not trying to play gotcha. You're just trying to kind of understand that when you ask for help, you're not worried about the fact that, well, people must think I'm incompetent if I ask a question, but rather I want to ask a question because I'd like to get smarter. That's why I'm asking this question, not because I'm stupid, but because I want to know more. And you can just think about how these things can be seen in different ways. Trust is the basis for what we now talk about as making sure that people feel psychologically safe in the workplace. I mean, it's interesting, the relationship between taking a risk and feeling safe. If you don't feel safe, you can't take a risk. You just won't. You just won't. But if you feel safe, if you feel, you know, you don't have to get it right the first time, if you feel like you can learn, if you feel like you can ask for help, then you're more willing to explore, experiment, put more time and energy into things than you might otherwise do. I know that one of the things that's really difficult is when organizations say, you know, it's like, I want you to innovate, but don't make any mistakes. Well, not going to happen. One of my favorite companies, I'll just tell you this. This is WD-40. I was with them recently, and in their organization, they never, never, never make mistakes. Never. No one makes mistakes, because their motto is you either win or you learn.
Yeah.
Either win or you learn. Of course they make mistakes, but they don't make mistakes. It's just an opportunity for them to learn.
It's a good reframe, isn't it? It's a really interesting reframe. WD-40, I think, is one of those companies. I don't know much about the organization. I know a lot about the product because it is a magic product, but what about other large organizations? I know you've done a lot of work with Apple and Amazon, and we're going to go back to the W's at one end of the alphabet. We'll go to the other end of the alphabet for a second. You see those companies with their, you know, they're large, they're massive organizations with complex structures and so on. Is it the same sort of issues? Is it the people issues the same in the size of the organization such as that? Is it because people are people, or are there different issues?
I think it's more of the same, but there's scale and scope.
Yeah.
If I've got a team of five people, you know, I just have more time and energy for those five people than I do for 25 people.
Sure.
Or 50 people. You know, the time is finite. You know, we only have 168 hours a week. So there are some differences. And what I have noticed, I was writing about this today, you know, I was coming up with these little epiphanies, you know, that today uncertainty is certain. That's the reality. And the new normal for us is never normal. And so we have to work actually harder than we have perhaps ever before, or maybe every generation feels this way, but it's true. We have to work harder. It takes more time and energy to be a good leader today than it did when, you know, things were certain. Everybody was in the office all at the same time. There wasn't as much competition. The globe wasn't as big. All those things. We often feel 24/7. We're 15 hours. You know, it's your morning. It's my night. It's my night. It's your morning. And yet here we are making a connection. So for all of us, as we aspire to provide leadership, it requires more personal effort. But I think the payoff is tremendous. I know that the best leaders get more out of their people than their counterparts who simply manage.
Yeah. That discretionary effort piece is really important, isn't it? If you're going to have if you're going to have your organization to grow, you want to get as much of that discretionary effort as possible. Barry, I wanted to talk about an interesting theme you touched on a moment ago, and that is change. The last few years has seen a lot of change, obviously with pandemics, any number of things, economic changes, interest rates, cost of living. I don't know if those sorts of things are happening quite so much in the United States. Perhaps they are, but here in Australia, they're very top of mind.
How about politics?
Yeah, politics is, yeah.
Are you in for me?
One of the things that I'm noticing is a sense of, in some places, not everywhere, but some places, a sense of collective fatigue. And you're having dealt with pandemics and lockdowns, and here in Australia, we probably had more lockdowns than most others, particularly in the city of Melbourne. They really had a lot of lockdowns. But there's just been kind of one thing after another after another. And I wanted to talk about resilience in leaders to be able to continue to keep fronting up for these challenges when their own sense of, you know, the depleting reserves of their own. How do you support leaders to be better leaders through that kind of stuff is what I'm getting at.
A myth that I think holds leaders back is the notion that it's lonely at the top.
Mm.
The only reason why it's lonely is if you isolate yourself, is if you don't make those connections with people around you. It's why encouraging the heart is so important these days, is to make sure that people know that you care about them, that you're concerned about them, that you have their best interests at heart. You know, empathy is becoming increasingly important. You know, even compassion, you know, suffering together. You know, when we ask our team to work on, you know, come in on the weekend, then, you know, again, a perfect example of modeling the way. It means then we ought to be coming in on the weekend. We ought to be right there with them. And it's oftentimes in those informal moments that we have a chance to make the most human connections, because it's not just the work, but we get a chance to talk about why we think it's important, and we get a chance to talk about all the things we're missing and our families and our hobbies and our this and that. And that reminds us that we're human. And then I think finally, you know, we've done a lot of research asking people about the characteristics, the personal values, traits, and characteristics that they most admire in someone that they'd be willing to follow. Mm. And the thing that for more than 30 years has been on the top of the list, whether it's Australia or Japan or Germany or the United States, is honesty.
Mm.
You know, and I'm not saying everybody is honest, but I'm saying that's the number one thing that in any relationship, you know, it's a part of trust. In any relationship, we want people to be honest. And then when I probe people with that more, and I say, so what does it mean when somebody's honest? Well, they tell the truth. So but how do you know it's the truth? And what's interesting is that one of the best ways we demonstrate our honesty and our truthfulness and our trustworthiness to others is when we're willing to be human and admit that we made a mistake.
Yeah.
That we didn't get it all right, that we goofed up, that we're sorry. That demonstrates to others that we're self-aware and that we're taking responsibility. We're not, you know, the other day I was coming to a meeting in another city, and I wasn't sure how long it was going to take me to get there. And I was hustling in the car to get there, and I was thinking about when I got there, I thought, well, I could either blame the fact that there were too many cars on the road, that's why I didn't get here. Or I could say, you know, I didn't leave early enough. Well, that sends two different messages. I didn't leave early enough. It was my responsibility, rather than, you know, what's wrong with this city? You know, there's too many people, and, you know, and there's not enough. Well, blame others. You know, no, I got to blame myself. I'm not there on time. It was my fault, not the fact that, you know, too many people on the highway.
I think that's a really, really important thing. And as you say, it's going to create that trust, that honesty. You know, if we can take that personal responsibility, be honest about what's really going on, it does create that trust. It does create that connection. And then that engenders others to do the same. I wanted to ask you to look forward into the future, if I can, a little bit, because you've been in the leadership space now for, you know, the Leadership Challenge was published 30 plus years ago. And so you've got this wonderful perspective of time, you know, and we can look at past and present, and of course I'd like to look to the future. What do you see for future leaders needing to be important that perhaps hasn't been important in the past? Are there things that need to be considered now that perhaps weren't considered in the past, or is it going to be the same principles you think that if people can master, we'll see them through?
Well, I hope you ask that question to all the people you talk with, Jess, because then you can collect all those answers and you can tell us about the future.
It'd be great, wouldn't it? It'd be wonderful. So in your best thinking, I know it's a cheeky question, but...
We've written 7 editions of the Leadership Challenge, and we continue to collect stories of people telling us about the times that they've been at their personal best. And And every time we come out with a new edition, somebody says, well, have you discovered a sixth practice? Is there something else that you haven't discovered? And first of all, I should say that these five practices, there's no guarantee that if you engage in these five practices that you're going to be successful. You can do all these things and still get fired, you know, or the product doesn't work. But the good news is, two pieces of good news. One is, if you at least do these things, you increase tremendously the probability of success. And we ought to be suspicious of anybody that thinks they have a model that predicts the future or guarantees success. So I'm saying, look, these things will increase the probability of success, but they also allow style points. You know, you can have a variety of different personalities. You can be outgoing or quite quiet. You can be tall. You can be short. You can have long hair. You can have short hair. You can be, you know, you can be a man. You can be a woman. You can, you know, you can be in finance or you can be in engineering. You can be in Australia or you can be in America. When I think about the things that people need to do going into the future, the thing that I think is most important, and it's been most important throughout these years, is trying to be able to answer the very first question that people want to know if they're going to be in a relationship with you, whether it's personal or organizational. They want to know who you are. And if we appreciate that, then it means that I need to answer that question for myself. I need to spend enough time reflecting to be able to say, this is who I am, and these are my values, and they inform the way I make decisions. And if you know my values, you'll understand why I do the things that I do and why I care about the things that I do. And maybe that won't be your cup of tea, but at least you'll know where I'm coming from. And if these values resonate with you, then we're going to have a great relationship and we're going to go together on the same path. So however you get to that, whether you get to that through your podcast, just a plug for you, Jess.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Through your podcast or some other way, that's the thing that I think is going to be just increasingly important, and particularly in a world in which it's harder to keep secrets. So we're you know, social media and other things, we're kind of always on.
The reason I asked that question was about principles that remain bedrock and don't change. And what I'm hearing from you is that the principles will be the principles, and maybe the context will change perhaps in the future, but we come back to that first principles approach and we apply those. And as you said, who am I? What are my values? What do I stand for? What are the things that influence my decision making? You may not agree with them, but at least you know where you're going to stand. And that, I think, is a really useful starting point, isn't it? It's a really powerful starting point.
Yeah. And maybe it's a good ending point for our podcast.
I think it probably is. Barry, thank you so much for taking the time, mate. I'm very grateful to you for tuning in all the way from San Francisco. It's a really thought-provoking podcast, Barry, because I'm sitting here and you can probably see my cogs are turning as we're going, because I'm thinking about all these things. And what I appreciate is this is not a formulaic seven steps to leadership. This is, yes, we've got those five practices, but there's so much layers and depth and practice in amongst all that, and their principles. And I really appreciate that. It's a very useful framework, but I love the fact that it's not didactic as well. So thank you for sharing it. I'm really grateful.
My pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me, and I look forward to visiting you sometime in Canberra.
Well, as I said at the outset, mate, you're one of the few overseas guests that we have that knows where Canberra is. So if you come to Canberra, I'll definitely take you out for a beer or a coffee or whatever you feel like, and we'll definitely do that. So thank you once again, Barry.
A pleasure. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.